Broadcasting.
Hello. Welcome. We're starting a little bit late. This is the House Committee on Revenue, Thursday, April 22nd. We have several items on our agenda today. And before we start, would you please call the roll?
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is present and pleased to be here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is present by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you, everybody. We're all here. I plan to take the items on the agenda in the order that the agenda was published. First, we're having a public hearing. I'm opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 120.
Okay, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And Senate Bill 120 is a bill that comes to you as introduced at the request of the Department of Revenue. And the bill has to do, it relates to the calculation of tax refund interest for the Department of Revenue in certain instances. So the bill in front of you is really, there's a bit of a story behind this one, but it's about a change that occurred in Senate Bill 33 in 2017. And there was an errant on included in that statutory change that was related to refund interest and changing the calculation of refund interest. But so if you're looking for the change in Senate Bill 120, it is on the first page of the bill, and it's simply in line 9. And you can see just right there is where it's removing the on. And that's the only change in Senate Bill 120. But it would make this change retroactive to January 1st, 2018, which is when that on was inserted into statute. And the implications for this is because of that on, it does in certain situations, and I believe Department of Revenue has an example in their testimony for today, but in certain situations, that on can change the timing of when the refund interest clock begins, which can have implications then for how much refund interest is accumulated by a taxpayer. So again, because of that and making this change retroactive, it would basically eliminate that inconsistency that exists right now in statute. We do have the paperwork on that if you want to see it from the fiscal and the revenue impact. But again, the revenue impact, the reason that you see a positive revenue impact reflects basically avoiding that calculation of that refund interest and that inconsistency.
Thank you. Committee, do you have any questions for Mr. Easton? We do have one witness signed up from Department of Revenue. We will hear from someone in a few minutes, but do you have any questions now for LRO? Okay.
Questions on this bill?
Or at or in? Let's start with the witness registration. And Manny, was there anyone who signed up in that last period of time since we printed the list?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have one witness, Marjorie Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Legislative Director for Revenue, and Kyle has certainly explained the background of this bill, and that the Department of Revenue pays interest on overpayments of taxes paid, and the law specifies how that interest is calculated and how it accrues. And as Kyle indicated, Senate Bill 33 in 2017 was intended to change the way the interest is calculated, but not change when that interest would start to accrue. So again, there is an example in our testimony that shows that this bill will clarify that the interest will begin to accrue on overpayments on the latter 45 days after the due date or 45 days after the date the tax was paid. So this is just a minor change. It was included in legislation in the February 2020 session. And just in case Senate Bill 120 doesn't move forward, which we would appreciate your support if it does, the provisions of this measure are also included in House Bill 2456. So it's helpful to make this change, and happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Ms. Taylor? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Taylor, Mr. Easton had mentioned that you might have an example for us. Do you have an example you could share?
Chair Nathanson and Representative Reschke, in our written testimony online, there is an example of the impact that the current provisions of law would how the interest is calculated, in that if a taxpayer pays their tax on, say, February 20th, however the due date is April 15th, that person wouldn't receive the interest if they're due a refund. However, if somebody pays their taxes April 30th, and that's 15 days after the due date, that person could receive interest on their refund. So it's just a little bit of an inequity regarding when they actually make their payment. So we're just clarifying that in this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. What are the implications of this for past tax returns? We're making it retroactive. So are we actually going back and doing adjustments? And are those to the benefit of the taxpayer or the detriment of the taxpayer? Is it going to vary?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Marsh, we'll certainly have to look into those impacted taxpayers and make those adjustments accordingly. And again, if there is interest that is due, then I'm sure that we will be making that adjustment for them, and that could be in their favor.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I would just say, if I may add a comment, I think it would be unfortunate to go back and try and negatively adjust for a typo that we made ourselves over the past couple of years for amounts that probably are not that great.
Thank you for the comment, Rep. Marsh. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Marjorie. I'm trying to wrap my arms around how LFO shared with us that there's no expenditure impact. Can you help this committee understand that, or is this something we ought to take a harder look at in LFO?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, good morning. So LFO would be quantifying the fiscal impact of administration of this, and we anticipate that it's minor, if any, with regard to administration. So...
Follow-up question?
Sure.
Thank you. And so within the GenTech system, there's not going to need to be any modifications, no new personnel, any of that?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I appreciate the clarification about GenTech. No, we anticipate that there would be an insignificant amount of programming associated with this.
Awesome. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thank you, Marjorie.
Yes.
That's a lot better news than what we often hear, which is, oh, that's going to cost $300,000 and I don't know how many hours of time.
Exactly.
Good news. Any other questions for Ms. Taylor? I'm going to take down the hands that I see left on the screen. LRO, do you have any other comments or observations before I close this public hearing?
No, Madam Chair, I would just mention in terms of the paperwork, again, the fiscal impacts talks about the fiscal cost, but on the revenue impact, that does speak to the potential interest and really the avoiding of that interest by making that change going forward and the retroactive amount, as that would account for the past years as well. So that may address some of the questions in the discussion.
Okay, thank you. I don't see anything else right now, so I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 120. Next, we have two work sessions. I will take them in the order that they are listed on the agenda. And as a reminder or an observation for people who are following us and this committee's work, these work sessions are posted with the annotation "for discussion purposes only." We do not plan to take any motions or actions on these items today. It's an opportunity for the committee to make sure that we understand how the bill works, what the intent is, any of the specifics around it, ask questions, kick the idea around a bit, but it's for a committee discussion. For each of these bills, we do have one or more people present to answer questions if there are questions about the intent or some technical issues that LRO would rather leave to someone in an agency or an organization, for example, to explain to us. So people are available to us, but we are not asking for presentations this time. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3373.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. This bill, the committee had the public hearing on April 5th, and it would create the Office of Taxpayer Advocate within the Department of Revenue with the idea or the goal of it helping the office, would help taxpayers understand the policies and procedures of DOR and help resolve any taxpayer problems. Some of the discussion that you heard then was comparison of this program to those in other states. I think about 30 or 35 other states have some sort of similar program. There were some questions on the office size, what the intent and what the vision would be. There were some, whether it be like an office of one person or much larger. I believe the department testified that it would be a few people. And then there were also questions about the independence of the office within the Department of Revenue. And you do have Betsy Imholt, the director of the Department of Revenue, in the waiting room. And I believe she's here to discuss ongoing conversations about an additional amendment to the bill. I believe DOR has been working with Rep. Fahey, I believe.
Okay. Committee, I'd like to then call on Ms. Imholt to describe what they have in mind for an amendment, because it may answer some of our questions or raise others. So let's hear what they have in mind, since apparently there's some more work that we're going to see beyond just what's in the bill as it is printed. And I hope that that Ms. Imholt or others will also clarify. The bill talks about taxpayer, and I think that when my constituents hear the word taxpayer, they're picturing themselves, an individual person filing a tax return. But we know, because of all of the work we do in our committee, that taxpayers may be businesses. Whether it's an incorporated corporation or not is kind of not the question, but it could be a business. It doesn't mean just an individual, you know, like the neighbor in my district or the neighbor in your district. Taxpayer is any entity paying taxes. I hope that becomes clear in the testimony also. Ms. Imholt, you're in the room, right?
I am here.
Could you tell us what else you have in mind, and then the committee will have maybe a lot of questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Betsy Imholt, Director of the Department of Revenue. Happy to be here today talking about this very important bill. We are working with a number of partners on further amendments to this bill, really building off of that Dash One amendment that we talked about with you last time. And so we hope to bring to you a consensus amendment soon. And the scope of that so far is a few things. One is we hope to call out very specifically that our tribal partners will be eligible grant recipients. That was an error on our part that must be rectified. And that would be for this grant program for tax help, tax assistance. That would be provided through third parties, not through us. We would be administering the grants, but the grants would be provided by community-based organizations, tribal partners, et cetera. We also have a small technical fix on the grant services to be provided. It was written in a way that was more exclusive than we meant it to be, that a grant recipient would have to provide all the services, and we really don't mean it to be that way. It can be a mix and match. So one may be able to provide more like outreach and getting folks to the services where others really provide the specific tax help. I think we have to be flexible in that. We know that all the services need to be provided, but who may be really good at the tax help may not be the exact same people who are good at the outreach and the communication with the community group. So I think we needed to be more specific about that. The Rules Advisory Committee for developing the grant program, we are being much more specific and inclusive around the members of that Rules Advisory Committee and just calling out the membership of that group to be very specific about all the folks that we want to make sure are represented at the table. And then regarding the independence, a couple things are at play there. One is beefing up the reporting element. So the way that the bill was originally drafted is the reporting element from this work of the Office of the Taxpayer Advocate was really a report one time from the department to the legislature. And we are changing that to make it a biennial report, and it would be direct from the taxpayer advocate to you. And so it's just a direct reporting on all of the things that were that the Office of the Taxpayer Advocate is seeing. And so there's really not that really bureaucratic filter, if you will, of the department. And so you're getting that straight from the taxpayer advocate. The last thing that we're working on, and we don't have resolution yet, is around the idea of an order or issuing an order, which is really like an interruption of our process by the taxpayer advocate. We didn't have that included in the original legislation. And this is something that many states do, the IRS does. And I agree with it in concept. It's just a matter of the details. We have 37 tax programs. They all have different administrative processes around them. And as I said in my original testimony, the taxpayer advocate is meant to be assistance and facilitation, but not a new appeals process. And that gets really complicated really fast. And so we're trying to figure out how we can draft that in a way that is meaningful, but not overcomplicates all of these other administrative processes, tax court, all these other, very long established processes that are already in place. So more on that to come. We're actively engaging with the business community and with DOJ to see if we can figure out a way to, and I'll just be very transparent with you, I want to start slow down that road, but I'm open to it. So we'll see if we can land something there. And that's where we are.
Committee, questions for Ms. Imhold or for LRO? Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Imhold. I know that last year the governor had a work group to talk about increasing participation in the earned income tax credit. How does this Office of Taxpayer Advocate consider some of the recommendations of the governor's work group?
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson and Rep. Pham. I think this is really an outcome of it, because one of the things that the work group recommended was increasing tax help And so this grant program that's really community-based is really providing that. And really at a more, you know, just as mentioned in the hearing, more important now than ever because the pandemic has really shrunk that service. So I think it was already a need before and it's even in more need now. And so this really gets at that.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I am not seeing a fiscal associated with this yet. I mean, obviously we're still making changes to the program that could affect the fiscal, but I'm wondering when we'll get an estimate of program costs. Because the more you talk, the more expensive it sounds.
Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, if I may, I think the costs are really in two ways. The staffing, which I mentioned before, we're estimating at 4. They would be phased in throughout the biennium, so they don't all start at full speed at the beginning. But there is a cost to doing this work because you can't really do community engagement work without people to do the work. So there is a cost in that, and I'm not going to sugarcoat that. There is a cost of doing that. But I think it's worth it, and I think it's important, and we will get a lot of value from making the investment. The other cost is the grant program itself, and that's scalable, right? So right now we spend nothing, and the community partners are envisioning, and I totally support this, so does the governor's office, a $6 million investment. But it doesn't have to be $6 million. I mean, that's a very scalable amount.
Representative Smith. Representative Smith, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Sorry. I'm kind of in the camp with Representative Marsh. I'm trying to ask my question without being confrontational. Shouldn't the people who are taking calls already be an advocate? Shouldn't they already be able to step up and assist without having to go to a third party?
No, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I really appreciate the question because I feel like in many ways, our employees do this all the time within the scope of their existing jobs, right? But you have to think about our public service reps who are on the phones, but they are on their phones Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, taking questions on an inbound line. That is different than proactive community engagement work. It is not the same thing.
I see.
And so, you know, if that's what we want to keep doing, then we can keep doing that. I think when your whole business is built around a voluntary compliance model, which ours is, and that's the cheapest, most effective way to do our work is to encourage people and get them the information they need on the front end so that they file their returns and do it without being asked to. That we will get a lot more bang for our buck by building relationships, not being the big scary tax man, you know, and that takes work. That takes being in the community. That takes people knowing who we are. And that I don't think really exists right now.
No, that's logical. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Rep. Valderrama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say I really appreciate this bill concept. I think it's phenomenal. And, you know, especially in my district and lots of communities of color, I see so many barriers to filing taxes, whether they're language issues or just not knowing how to navigate even the devices or internet access, et cetera. So I'm really looking forward to seeing some of the culturally specific and individualized support that it sounds like this bill would be able to offer, which I'm excited about. And I was just wondering if you can share a little bit more about how that could happen or what the vision is there specifically for individuals and how the really community-based, culturally appropriate tax assistance can really be a new service, and just expand a little bit more there, since that's something that I'm particularly interested in.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Rep. Valderrama. I think I'm not going to pretend to have all of the answers and even the vision for how exactly that would look. But what I do know is that the department can help build that in partnership. And that's what I really saw as the void, is that there was a lot of talk about doing this, but I really didn't. You know, didn't seem like much was happening. And I think that's where we can be helpful, is, you know, setting the table. You know, someone's got to like make, get the money and like get the rules going and like set up the program. But we are never going to be the best messenger for this directly to taxpayers, because we are the Department of Revenue. But I think that we can partner with the groups who are. And that's the part where I think we really play the role, is making sure that we're building the connections in the community. And just realistically, it's probably not with the individuals. It's probably with the groups, who then can build connections with the individuals. I just think we have to be realistic about who we are and who, where we can have our biggest impact. So that's my goal, is really to partner with the groups who we've been starting to partner with. They, a lot of them really testified at our last hearing. And so we're talking about, you know, Metropolitan Family Services, NAIA, Stanford Children, the Neighborhood Works Partnership, College Possible, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I hope that this becomes a very big tent, and we can really go from there. And that's my goal.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Eibholt. On the grant and outreach portion of this bill, which seems to be the dash one right now, is this done in the other states that have a advocate in their Department of Revenue? Is that typical? And then I guess my other question is, do you have a state or states that you plan on modeling this office around? I'm sure different states do it differently. So I'm wondering if you have one in mind that we could take a look at, or maybe there's a couple you like, so I can get a better idea what this looks like.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chair Reschke. Great question. We have done tons of research on other states and how they've set up their programs. And we haven't found one that has an equity focus. That's not been something that we have encountered. I will say, though, the IRS does a lot of work in the grant-making sphere. That's probably closer our model, and does a lot of tax help. So that's really the closest example, is the IRS.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm going to ask a question about geographic spread of outreach, the outreach programs. Much of the questions over the last few minutes have been about just one part of the bill. The bill was most notably identified as establishing an Office of Taxpayer Advocate, but that's not what most of these questions are about. Most of these questions are about a grant program to help spread the word in communities and to get to people who may not be filing taxes because there are barriers to understanding what it's about or how to do it. In the past, outreach programs have largely focused on either AARP tax aid, which is statewide, or Cash Oregon, which is very much focused in the Portland metropolitan region. Other than those two, and then there is some outreach or assistance that the federal government assists with through money that it makes available. Other than those, are there any established programs that are doing a significant amount of tax prep assistance? You've named a number of programs that can do outreach and get to communities of people, but how many are actually doing tax assistance? And are you talking about outreach to get people more comfortable in answering questions, or are we going to be training up a lot more programs in literal tax assistance? And will it be statewide or still largely heavily centered on the Portland metro area?
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your indulgence, I would love to ask our Cody Trudell, who's doing the research on this and has a much better handle on that question, that answer, than I do, if she could share with us this constant moving target of who's providing which services where. I believe there is still services being provided statewide, but I hesitate to name who's doing what where.
If Cody's available, that's fine. And we do have, I think, additional questions from Reps Pham and Smith. And I'm going to do a time check after that, because we do have one other bill today.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Director Imholt. Yes, I'm here and I'm happy to speak to that. In the course of my research, I think the most glaring thing is that because of the pandemic, we have lost a lot of those other resources that were present in doing this work throughout the state. There were some hubs before that were providing direct tax preparation work besides AARP and Cash Oregon. And unfortunately, a lot of them were already scrambling to stay together and help more people prior to the pandemic, but definitely with the pandemic, we have seen some of those shut down.
Sure. Cody, before you continue, please state your name for the record.
Oh, I apologize. Cody Trudell with the Department of Revenue. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. And I want to focus on the future, not what we've lost for this year, because I think we're all hoping and trusting that the pandemic situation is time limited and not a new permanent state.
Yeah. So the exciting news is that I have talked to some of these programs and they have mentioned that some of the programs that have discontinued and some that are still around, they have said this grant program would help them. They would be able to come back. And there have been some very creative solutions to how we would further bring other agencies into the room.
Thank you. Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Well, you know, in my area, we have a large population of Hispanics and a large population of tribal members. And I know that in the city of Pendleton, which is the major big city, and in the city of Hermiston, we do have tax advocates that speak different languages. And they do tax filings for free. And I see their advertisements in our local newspaper to be part, to get more people to come in and file taxes. And they're just regular CPAs that have, you know, that file taxes for people. How would they get grant money then to participate in this specific program? Because I know they're privately owned businesses, but they have made the effort to do the outreach to not the English speaking people that we have. You know, we have quite a large amount of people that don't, that English is not their first language.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Representative Levy, I think that's a question that we have started to work with the CPAs on too, especially as it relates to, this is a very preliminary introductory level conversation, but to small businesses. And are they, you know, I've just opened the question to them in an exploratory way about, you know, how can we partner together around offering tax help, targeting just exactly what you're talking about, our non-English speaking businesses with CPA services. And so I don't have a good answer for you yet, because I think we're just in the very early stages of understanding how we like build this part of the program. But let's just like agree that there's a need. And some people are filling the gaps where they can, or just doing community service because that's who they are. And that's amazing. Like, that's great. And so I think, you know, our door is open and problem solving, and if there's ways that we can like figure that out, like we're all in.
Well, thank you very much. I just know that some of the businesses in our area that are providing these services, you know, and they're providing it for free. They're not charging. So the grant program would be very helpful for them.
Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Betsy, I understand this is fluid and there's a lot of details to still be worked out. How do you anticipate, though, quantifying success? How are we going to measure that? What's going to be the return on investment? Or how do you plan on flushing through that in the future?
Yeah, Representative Nathanson and Representative Smith, thank you. My most relevant experience for this is if you think back to when you all passed the Student Success Act, included in that was the Early Childhood Equity Fund, which was, it was similar. It's a $10 million fund set aside for early childhood equity programs without a lot of parameters. And when I was at the Early Learning Division, that really we sat down in partnership with community groups and in a rules advisory committee and wrote that program together. And that's really the model I see using for this. So to jump to the end, I mean, I think success is more filing, right? More filing is good for everyone. It's great for us. It's great for taxpayers for a lot of reasons. One is you're in the economy. Like that is the sign, like you're in. But it also could provide you great benefit, like could provide you great tax benefit, but it also, not filing your taxes can stand in between you and employment. I mean, there's all sorts of things that could stand between you and your kid going to college, right? So tax filing is good. And so more filing is the measure of success. I think there's a lot between how we get where we are today and how we get there and the interim measures of success. What are those? I think we have to build those in partnership. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to say, we're going to do A, we're going to do B, we're going to do C, because in my experience, especially when you're working in a program with that's really focusing on marginalized communities, you really need to do that with them, not to them. And so I'm going to be vague because I think that's what I think that is how a program like this should be developed.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Sure.
And Betsy, I get the wisdom of what you're saying, and I think there is tremendous social benefit. I also do believe, though, that there's going to be huge financial benefit to the state, as you mentioned, getting folks into the economy. I would hope in the future we would be able to kind of quantify both the social benefit and the financial benefit. Thank you.
And committee, I see only one more hand, Rep. Pham. I'd like to plan on taking just one more question and response so that we can move on to our next bill. That's my hope. Let's see if we can get there. Rep Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yes, I just want to say that I really appreciate this bill. In my community, so many members of my community find filing their taxes very intimidating and very complicated because of technical challenges and language challenges. And as we heard in the previous hearing about the underutilization of the earned income tax credit, a lot of them just don't file because of these obstacles, even though they'd be eligible for thousands of dollars that could really help their family. So I just really see this as a very connected to the earned income tax credit. And I remember hearing, I was very struck hearing from the Oregon Business Council about their support for boosting our participation in the earned income tax credit, and that if we boosted up to 90% participation for those eligible for the EITC, that it would add something like $85 million in stimulus funds and other huge numbers in extra revenue. So I just want to echo what Representative Smith was saying about the financial benefits that it would offer our state, as well as the social benefits. And I hope that maybe LRO might be able to provide some analysis about some of the revenue. I think OBIC said it might even be revenue neutral. I think they were talking about just boosting participation in EITC. But if we could get some analysis about some of the, whether it's the local economic multipliers that come from getting more revenue and the earned income tax credit, to some of the social benefits as well, that would be super helpful.
Thank you, Rep. Pham. Committee, are there any other questions before we close this work session? And if you have additional questions, we can always send them to Mr. Alanak to get a response, either from LRO or DOR. I'm not seeing any. Thank you, everybody, for a lot of good questions. Thank you, Department of Revenue, for being with us.
Chair Nathanson, I think Rep. Marsh below in the guest had a quick question. She had her hand up for a brief sec.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I can defer if you're concerned about time. I'm interested.
If you want to get it on the record, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just quickly note, it would be interesting to have some baseline data in terms of how many people we think file for federal taxes and not state, or some way of measuring our success with a program like this over time, because if one of those markers is more people filing, how can we establish a baseline so that we can measure that over time?
Noted. Thank you, Rep. Marsh. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3373. We're ready for the next one. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3295.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3295, you heard on March 8th. And just to refresh your memory about what the bill is attempting to do, is basically trying to fix a problem that occurred with the distribution of marijuana revenue to the counties. Previously, as the county and city distribution was contemplated at the time of drafting all the laws on legalization after Measure 90 passed, the idea was you're either all in or all out. And at that time, I think there was some county, especially in this case, Deschutes County, that was in and allowed the different types of businesses. However, there came a time when that condition changed. And what happened is because of the way we have the statutes written, it ended up that the county is no longer eligible to receive these distributions from the marijuana funds. Now, among all of these, and during this time, passes Measure 110, of course, and reduces the amounts to be distributed from all the revenues to about $90 million a biennium, or $45 million a year. And the cities and counties, they both get 10% of that, so about $4.5 million a year for each group. And this bill was trying to reestablish a way of allowing the county, especially Deschutes County, that already has the businesses existing, to receive some of the distributions of the fund as defined newly. They that's what you heard the last time, and now there is a Dash 1 amendment. And the Dash 1 amendment basically actually simplifies a lot of the language with relative to Measure 110 and how it interferes with the revenue and revenue distributions. But I think it took a more simple, so a more simplified solution on how to deal with this issue, is by allowing the counties or the cities who had businesses or who had the conditions prior to January 1st, 2018, to continue receiving these distributions as if they were the same type of business under the same formula that I have laid out in your background material in the SMS. So that's what the Dash 1 is trying to do, simplify that distribution, get away from this problem that prevented some of the counties, especially Deschutes County, from receiving distributions of the revenue. So that's what you have in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Malik. Committee, again, this is an opportunity for us to kick around the idea, see what the amendments are about. And before we proceed, I would like to call on Representative Kropp, if he's here with us, to tell us in layperson's language what this or any other amendment is intended to do, why there's an amendment, just the nuts and bolts, and in plain language. We have the technical statutory language, but explain it to us. And committee, we also have others with us representing Deschutes County and Association of Oregon Counties who are here to answer questions if you have questions about the intent or how this particular bill or amendments would work. So Rep. Kropp, are you with us?
I am, Chair Nathan. So Chair Nathan, thank you. Jason Kropp, State Representative, House District 54. Most of Bend, Oregon. Thanks for having me here today. In very plain terms, let me start off by saying what this bill does not do. This bill does not impact the distributions of money under Measure 110. This bill would not have any detrimental impact on the distributions under the Marijuana Equity Act if that were to pass this House. It would not impact those monies for that at all. The other places that Oregon marijuana account or marijuana revenue goes to, which is the state school fund, mental health treatment, the state police or prevention programs, or cities, it does not have an impact on those funds or the amount allocated now to those entities. What this does is it has an impact on how the county share of revenue is distributed to the participating counties. So right now, counties receive 10% of the Oregon marijuana account distributions. That will be reduced greatly by Measure 110 implementation. And this bill basically says is if you're a county that participates in the marijuana economy of the state, then you receive a part of that 10% slice of revenue based on what your participation level is. So the amendment, the original bill had language in relations to our cities and our counties. The amendment just deals with our counties. So the county distribution right now is, if you are an opt-in county, a county that allows for processing, production, wholesale, or retail sales, you get a share of that revenue. And that share is based on two different numbers. One is how many total acres do you have in marijuana production compared to the rest of the state? And then how many of those other types of licenses do you have, processing licenses, wholesale and retail licenses do you have in relation to the other licenses in the state? So for example, Jackson and Josephine County have the most acreage in the state for marijuana production, and they get a larger allocation of that money than counties that have fewer acres. What this amendment does is it takes away the requirement that you have to be, after 2018, an opt-in county to allow further licenses or further production or other types of marijuana licenses. So admittedly, Deschutes County finds itself in this very unique position, which is we are a participant in the Oregon marijuana economy. We have the eighth most licenses for production in the state. We have the fifth most licenses for processing in the state. We have the seventh most licenses for wholesale in the state. And we have the seventh most licenses for retail in the state. But recently in 2020, we as a county took a vote and we decided not to issue any more production or processing licenses. We still are processing existing requests for licenses, and we're still able to grant new wholesale and retail licenses. But because of that recent opt-out, we are no longer eligible for marijuana revenue, even though we will continue to be a significant producer and significant participant in the Oregon marijuana economy. And I'll just give an example. I just looked up the counties that are sort of neighboring the capital, Yamhill, Polk, and Marion County. Deschutes County has more licenses for every of those four categories than Polk County. We are similar to Yamhill County in licenses for production, but more licenses in the other three counties, the three categories. And in Marion County, we have more production licenses, more licenses for processing, more licenses for wholesale, but fewer licenses for retail. Polk, Yamhill, and Marion County will get a share of that marijuana revenue, but Deschutes County will not, even though arguably Deschutes County participates in a greater extent in the Oregon marijuana economy than those other counties. So that is, hopefully that's an explanation of just how the counties would distribute that money. And really it's based on participation in that marijuana economy. You know, we've worked closely with AOC on the language to make sure that this is not, this is a bill that would work for all counties. It's not sort of one county versus 35 counties. And we've worked with the Department of Revenue to make sure that the language is sensible. I'm not suggesting that the Department of Revenue has a position on this bill, but more just that the language is correct.
Committee members, time for discussion or questions, and we do also have some people representing the interests of counties on the line. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Representative Krupp, we've talked about this some. So my understanding is this situation came to the fore because there was a ballot measure in Deschutes County, and the voters chose to step away from some marijuana involvement. Is that's correct?
Representative Marsh, that's correct. There was a ballot measure in the fall that put a moratorium on production and processing licenses. Doesn't impact the county's ability to issue new wholesale and retail license. So we find ourselves in the unique position of, as a county, having these existing businesses, allowing certain types of licenses to proceed forward, and certain types of licenses, a moratorium on those licenses. We're the only county in the state in that position.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure.
And the county commissioners put that measure on the ballot?
That was put forward by the county commissioners, yes, for them to be on the ballot for the fall.
And one more question, Madam Chair?
Sure. Sure.
And presumably when they did so, they understood the rules about marijuana tax distribution and the consequences that could have for their county.
Yeah, so Representative Marsh, good question, and I don't speak for my county commissioners. When we've had that discussion, I went back and I looked at the voters pamphlet for the 2020 election and looked at the statements that was in the voters pamphlet that was presented to the voters. There was no indication of those voter pamphlet statements that this would have a negative impact on Deschutes County's ability to receive marijuana revenue. And I can't tell you if that's a, well, I can, all I can say is I read those different statements, and I think actually I provided those to your office, and it doesn't mention what the potential impact would be on revenue or not revenue.
Thank you.
Mr. Alanak or Mr. Malik or Rep. Kropp, what do we know about legislative background, legislative discussion on the underlying problem, which is you've got to be all in or you're all out? Was it ever anticipated that there could be a sort of a partial situation like this?
Thank you, Chair. You know, I sort of, and I'll lean a little bit on Rod Bovet for this, who was part of the drafting of the original bill on how the marijuana account revenue would be allocated. I don't think anybody anticipated there would be this sort of participating county in the Oregon marijuana economy that then made a decision to stop certain types of licenses. So they're sort of partially in, partially out. So I don't think that's been contemplated. I will sort of mention what was contemplated in 2019 by this legislature was the ability for OLCC in general to put a moratorium on issuing new production licenses based on the production of the state and what the demand and the need was in the state. So I think as we've fine-tuned our marijuana laws, there has been contemplation about how do we not overproduce marijuana in the state, and I guess in some respects my county has made that decision on a county basis. But I'll lean on Rod Bobet. I don't think it was ever contemplated that there'd be a county in the position like Deschutes County, which is, you know, a participating county who just said we are not going to issue, we're going to take a moratorium on new licenses.
Yeah. In other words, participating in part. Mr. Bovet, do you have anything to add?
Chair Nathanson, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel and legislative director for the Association of Oregon Counties. And I did have a lot to do with the crafting of what is now ORS 475B. And back in the day when Mr. Malik and I and everybody was working on all these statutes, we were really talking about the ramping up of production and capacity. We were growing the system and kind of didn't think we were going to wind up in an overproduction situation so quickly. So as you probably know, OLCC has put a moratorium statewide on new production licenses, and Deschutes County has essentially done the same thing, although for slightly different reasons. Part of their reasoning was they have kind of a messy land use situation in Deschutes County that has gotten into some sticky wickets, but it is fundamentally an overproduction situation. So I think we had to in 2019, as the representative said, we kind of had to go into state law and allow OLCC to put on a moratorium. Deschutes County voters have put on their own moratorium, essentially in tandem, and it you know, just a matter of equity. We weren't really thinking about people doing this half in, half out thing because we were thinking it was all in, all out at the time. And I think our thinking has grown over time because the industry has grown and changed over time. So I don't know if that's of any assistance at all.
Thank you. Committee members, anything else come to mind? Sure, Rep. Valderrama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to ask a question. So I, Rep. Croft, I appreciate you just starting out by saying what other funds this doesn't impact. Those are some of the questions that I know I had previously. But of the way that the resources are currently distributed to counties, can you talk about of that pie slice, how this changes or could change any of the other revenue for other counties, in particular Multnomah County, right, which has a lot of retail currently. Could you share a little bit more about that?
Sure, and thank you, Representative Valderrama. I asked Department of Revenue to do some estimates based on implementation of Measure 110 and also based on the implementation of potentially the Oregon Marijuana Equity Act. So it would, there would be a distribution of approximately $35,000 to $45,000 per quarter to Deschutes County. So of the, I guess, roughly 20, of the roughly 20 plus counties that are participating, they would see a slight reduction quarterly of their revenue, depending on how much they sort of participate in the Oregon marijuana economy. So that's based on total acreage. Like I said, Jackson, Josephine County far outpace, I believe, the other parts of the state for marijuana production acreage. And then based on licenses, and I think Multnomah County is the leading retail license county in the state. So $35,000 to $45,000 per quarter is the estimate I've gotten from Department of Revenue.
I'd like to ask Mr. Bovet to respond, because you're here representing counties generally, not an individual county. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think this bill is really just a matter of equity, kind of fairness. As Representative Krupp mentioned, Deschutes County just did a moratorium on, you know, one of the types of on production, basically, and processing associated with it. And so is it, I guess the question is it fair to basically say, since you put a moratorium on those two license types, we're going to exclude you from any revenues, even though you're continuing to need to regulate all those that you previously let in and everyone else that's coming in on the two existing types? And plus with the overlay of the state having a moratorium on production anyways, to me, it just seems like we've got a fairness issue going on here. But, you know, if the legislature makes the policy decision, we're just going to stick with all in or all out. And if you put a moratorium on anything for any reason, you're just going to get denied all of those resources. I know that's a policy choice you could make. I just want you to be open-eyed about that policy choice. To me, it just seems somehow unfair.
And that would be an observation from Association of Oregon Counties, right?
Yeah.
I
guess I should just say, you know, I can remember the actual day I was in Mr. Mazin's office, and we were crafting all this stuff, and we were carving it up because counties are basically the primary producer of the products, not actually the primary retailer. Most of the retail shops are actually located inside cities. So we took half of all of the county allocation, and it all goes to production counties based on is exactly what Representative Krupp said, which is your production volume. So Jackson and Josephine are always going to be at the top of that heap and, quite frankly, getting a larger percentage share, which was our design. That was our intent, because we're really trying to address production. And so Deschutes is still a major producer. And so I think the policy question is, because Deschutes has put a moratorium, much like the state, on new production licenses, should they be denied the revenues to support their regulation of what they previously allowed or not? I mean, I think you got a real clean policy choice to make.
Thank you. And what it seems that the estimate that Rep. Krupp has gotten isn't fine-tuned enough to show any negative impact on other counties? And are we talking about in the single thousands or the tens of thousands? Certainly not the hundreds of thousands a quarter, but it is.
Yeah,
what is the magnitude of the negative impact? Because I think that's really what Rep. Valderrama was trying to get at.
And Chair Nathanson and Rep. Valderrama, I think that's exactly right. I think we're talking about a total global impact of what, $120,000-$130,000 a year in terms of what Deschutes County would be restored in terms of funding. That would come out of the other county shares. In terms of the retail half, I suspect that's not going to have much dramatic impact. On the production part, it might. So, for example, the other high production counties could see a diminution in their distribution proportional to that. I'd have to actually do the math to figure out what that would be, but we're not talking large dollars, of course. We're talking about over $1,000 a year, yeah.
I think we get the concepts, but we're used to seeing numbers. And someone's going to do the math on this one.
Right. And Chair Nathanson, if I could add to that a little bit, you know, this isn't necessarily taking away from other counties because Deschutes County had been getting a distribution of marijuana revenue already that had just stopped recently. So this is not this bill wouldn't necessarily give new money to Deschutes County. It's money that had previously been already allocated. And like I said, the estimates from Department of Revenue are $35,000 to $45,000 per quarter.
Thank you, Rep. Krupp, for that most recent comment, because one way to look at it is the other counties would just continue in sort of a status quo situation as far as their distribution.
Right. And I think what you heard from county folks before is, you know, we'd spend that money on with our health department, substance abuse treatment issues and enforcement and regulation. And that need doesn't dissipate.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I think I understand the Deschutes situation quite well, and we can quantify that. But what happens when you're opening the door to all counties making passing ordinances, making changes in the kind of businesses that they are willing to license? And how do we have any backstop on that to know where that goes or where that leads? If you are in a position where you can cut off processing or cut off some other part of the operations, then it seems like total chaos to me.
Well, Representative Marsh, thanks for that question. I mean, part of the answer is we've already done that on a statewide level, right? We put a moratorium on production because of overproduction in the state, according to OLCC. I think part of it is, you know, individual counties have always had the ability to make certain decisions as far as land use and other decisions. And this doesn't necessarily impact this. What this allows is, based on the amount of sort of marijuana business that exists in your county, that will be your allocation of marijuana revenue. And so if Jackson and Josephine County continue to outpace, and if OLCC allows for new production licenses, then their share of revenue will go up relative to the other counties, which makes sense just because of, if you have more of those businesses in your county, then you have a greater need for that revenue.
Chair Nathanson, if I could also add, if it helps, we made it really easy for counties to opt in. They can just do it by enacting an ordinance. We made it very difficult for counties to opt out of any license category. It requires a vote of the people. So election is required to opt out of anything, but commissioners can opt into anything.
Thank you. Rep. Marsh, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, for Mr. Bravette. Back to the question that I asked Rep. Krupp, the county commissioners definitely understand the rules around this. And we can assume that when they put an effort on the ballot, that they understood that the consequences would be loss of tax measure. Is that a fair assessment?
Chair Nathanson and Representative Marsh, I'm not sure. You'd have to ask them. I do know that there is a there was maybe a lawsuit around this because I think of a disagreement in interpretation of the statutes between Department of Revenue and Deschutes County. So I think Deschutes County is actually arguing that they shouldn't be precluded even under the existing statute. But I don't know where that litigation is. I haven't been involved with it at all. So I really can't answer that question straight up because I don't know what was in their minds.
Thank you.
Mr. Malik or Mr. Alanak, what do we know about the status of any lawsuit? And is legislative counsel, have they issued any advisories to either Department of Revenue or have they provided any information to you about whether something might be up in the air right now?
Chair Nathan, I have not heard or been involved with talks of lawsuits, but to if you feel about the issues that you've asked about, we have went through this whole process and so on, and the as Mr. Bavette said, we've designed all these ways of doing it, and in the same time, the issue of opt-in and opt-out was primarily negotiated between the different segments of legalization discussions in almost in tandem with the early start program. So a lot of the counties when Measure 90 was passed had actually voted against it. So because they don't want to this
Mr. Malik, I'm sorry, but we're having some trouble with your audio right now. I'm going to call on Mr. Smith, and then if that doesn't resolve the question, we'll get back to you. Mr. Smith?
Yes, thank you and good morning. And my name is Adam Smith. I'm Assistant Legal Counsel for Deschutes County for the record. And also for the record, I apologize for the background. I'm currently en route to get my COVID vaccine. Otherwise, I, of course, wouldn't be driving in a car while testifying in front of the committee. So the lawsuit that you're asking about is currently stayed as Deschutes County is exploring other alternatives to try and address this problem. Primarily this this legislation, and to Representative Marsh's initial comments, if I may, it wasn't necessarily clear to Deschutes County what the implications would be after the county commissioners initially passed the opt-out ordinance. There were numerous correspondences back and forth with OLCC and DOR. Trying to figure out the tax implications to this bill. And it took months of conversation. The point was, it wasn't self-evident how the current statutes would apply to Deschutes County's situation because we previously, as has been noted, opted in on all four categories and then only opted out on two categories for new businesses going forward. So it took many months of conversation, and then ultimately it resulted in the disagreements that we're trying to solve short of litigation.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have additional questions? It's 10 minutes of 10. Thank you. I'll get to you, Rep. Levy, just a second. I'm doing a time check. It's 10 minutes of 10. Is everyone able to stay with us for a few more minutes? It looks like it. Okay. Representative Levy, yes, please.
So my question, thank you, Chair Nathanson, is for Rob Bovet. So I know my county does not get any marijuana monies. Are they able to opt back in? I think I heard you already say that, but are they able to opt back in for monies? Because we have, like my neighbor down the road leased my circle, my husband's and I circle, and the first thing he wanted to plant there was marijuana plants. And it's really not, it's the hemp plants for other products, not for the marijuana itself. But because of the smell, I said, no, you couldn't grow it there. But I know we grow it extensively in Umatilla County. So is Umatilla County able to opt back in for these funds?
Rep. Levy, that was for Mr. Bovet, is that right?
Yes, it was.
Okay, and I'm going to ask Mr. Smith to turn his camera off, please.
And Chair Nathanson, Representative Levy, I got bumped off somehow, and I just came back in the middle of your question, and I apologize. So could you summarize it again, and I'll take a stab at it.
I know that Umatilla, thank you very much. I know that Umatilla County has opted out, or they're not receiving marijuana funds. Do they have the opportunity to opt back in?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Levy, you bet. Umatilla County could opt into any one of the four license categories or all of them, as the case may be. The requirement would be to hold an election if you opt out. The commissioners could either do it unilaterally by commission action, or they could call for a vote. They have either option if they wanted to opt in. So there are two distinct pathways to opt into any or all of the marijuana licenses.
Good. I'll tell them to reach out to you, and you can explain it to them legally, not me. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, Rep. Marsh. And then Rep. Valderrama next.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Representative Levy's very interesting question raises a request for data, which is how many counties do we have out there that have one kind of license that would now have the door open to opt back into getting tax benefits?
I see people writing notes. Rep. Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just had another question. It's probably similar in this line of additional data and numbers. And we talked a little bit about equity, which I think is important for me. Racial equity is also very important. And really, again, looking back at our district in Multnomah County and how many of these resources are going to businesses of color, businesses owned by people of color, and making sure that we're investing and continuing to invest even, you know, at bare minimum status quo resources in those programs, which are particularly important, especially as we're on an economic recovery. So I just wanted to put that on the record and see if we can get any more specific information there on the data of what that might look like.
Rep. Valderrama, I'm going to ask you for a little bit of clarification about resources and businesses, which businesses?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to clarify. So as we get more numbers on potential negative impacts to other counties, I'm also interested if we can get additional information on any potential negative impact to businesses owned by people of color or other revenue streams that might impact some of the work that we've been doing to support new business owners as well.
Are there any other questions? Rep Levy, did you still have a question? Anything else? I'm going to wait another minute or so.
Chair Nathanson, I'll take an initial stab, if you don't mind, at Representative Marsh's question, and I can follow up with her as well. I mean, I think the new amended language for counties only talks about counties who had allowed the four types of marijuana businesses and then after January of 2018 had opted out, but still opted out of certain types of businesses, but still allowed existing businesses to operate. So I think right now, the only county that would be impacted would be Deschutes County. And obviously that potentially could change if other counties make modifications to what licenses they allow. But I don't think it would impact if a county that is not participating in the Oregon marijuana economy wants to start participating in the Oregon marijuana economy. I think that is still would be allowed and they would still potentially be able to receive revenue based on their level of participation.
Thank you, Rep. Krupp, for being with us. And thank you for the other people who joined us to provide information about the program, how it works, and what the bill is about. And I can't tell if Rep. Levy's hand is up again or not. Okay. I'm trying to lower it, and I'm not able to from my end.
And it's not up on my side.
Okay. It's just, we've both had issues with ghost images. Something's left over on the display. Anything else from the committee? I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3295. Mr. Allenack, any closing comments or observations?
I think there you had some good discussion and some good questions were raised. We'll work on getting those answers to you to further the conversation as you move forward in the session.
Thank you. And we have another meeting scheduled for this afternoon.
4 p.m.
Okay, there's no other business for this meeting. I'll see you later today. We're adjourned.